Okay, now we're on. This month, this Shabbat begins the Hebrew month of Elul. Elul is a time of spiritual closeness. It's a time when we prepare for the High Holidays. The High Holidays start in Tishrei. Rosh Hashanah is the first day of the year, the new year. And we're not supposed to just walk into the new year. We're supposed to actually get ready for it. And I think this is a really good way of getting ready and of preparing ourselves spiritually. And the first source I want to learn with you guys tonight is one of my most favorite texts from Maimonides. I'll tell you who the Rambam was in a minute, for those of you who are not familiar. But he wrote a treatise called Deot. Deot are qualities. There are many chapters. I'm just going to do the first chapter with you tonight. And he called it the Laws of Deot. And he believed, as you'll see, that being Jewish, religious, is not simply about performing the mitzvot. The mitzvot are supposed to actually refine and develop us in a certain kind of way. And we need to be conscious and mindful of it. And he's going to talk about the different temperaments and qualities that people possess and how we can actually learn to cultivate and develop them further. Maimonides lived in the 1100s in Spain and was then chased out by a radical Muslim sect, and spent rest of his life in other Arab parts of the world, where he was known as a great, great physician and philosopher. It's incredible how much this one man wrote. When my kids were little, they used to sing a song. It's called Mimosha Ad Moshe Lo Kam Kemosha. From Moses until Moses, his name was Moses Maimonides. It's before they had surnames, it was Moshe ben Maimon or Maimonides. There was never another Moshe. And he went from Spain to Egypt. He was actually initially supported by his brother, who was a very successful a merchant, died in a terrible expedition that Maimonides had some sort of inclination. There's a letter that's hanging in the Israel Museum in Jerusalem. The letter that the Rambam wrote to his brother not to go on the expedition that he died on. And after that point, Maimonides needed to start earning his own money. He didn't have his supportive brother anymore, and that's when he started practicing. He was considered one of the leading physicians at the time and a scientist. He also considered, and you'll see in a minute, he considered Aristotle intellectually his mentor, if you will, which is very interesting, and it also got him into a lot of trouble with the other rabbis. He was one of the first rabbis that started incorporating Greek philosophy into his writings. And you'll see it actually here in this first chapter. So that's a little background on the Rambam. Welcome.
Thank
you. How are you? Can you do me a favor before
yes.
you come in? Just, you see the lights behind you?
Yes.
I think they're dimmed for some reason. If you could, yeah.
Better?
That's it. That's perfect. Thank you. I don't know if that was so dramatically different. I was like, yeah. Dan was in Israel with us.
Yeah.
And it was an amazing trip.
Really?
Is this you?
This is me.
Okay, here, just pass this, please. Everyone, this is Dan Lastman. I'm sorry I introduced
Hello.
You for you. All right, follow with me. You guys with me? We're a nice, intimate group here, so if you have questions, you want to debate, argue, yell, scream, I don't know, whatever you want to do, please feel free. This is not a lecture. We're just going to learn this together. Cool? All right. Deot harbe yesh l'chol adam v'echad mimnei adam. And by the way, hello to everyone in Facebook Live land. I know you can't speak back, but it's great to have you here. So deot harbe, the Rambam says there are many deot, there are many character traits that l'chol adam, that each person possesses. V'zo mishuna mizu, and each one is quite different from the next. U'rechoka mimena biyoter, and they're actually, it can be incredibly distant from the others. Meaning, you'll meet some people that have certain qualities and certain traits, and other people that have almost opposite qualities and opposite traits. Yesh adam, there are some people, shu bal chema, who are, a bal chema is someone who is a master of anger. The English says constantly angry. By the way, this English translation was written by Rabbi Eliyahu Tuger. I don't know him, but he's of Chabad rabbi, who's a great scholar. Not everything is exactly literal, and he's got some excellent notes here. You're more than welcome to take this home when you're done with class tonight and read a little more on your own. on some of the comments because it's excellent. But a Baal Chema literally means a master of anger. Koes Tamid, he's always angry. Everything ticks this guy off. V'yesh Adam, and then you'll meet other people, Shedato Miyushevet Alav, whose, their da'at means their mind is Miyushevet. Yashav is to sit. What does that mean, their mind is sitting? They're like tranquil. They're like okay with stuff. Does anybody have any friends like this in life? They're really pleasant to be around. My father-in-law, he should rest in peace, was such a person. He was one of the most, I mean, I'm not just saying this because he was one of the most pleasant people I've ever met. He rarely got angry, and it was just traffic. He couldn't take traffic. He would blow up if there was traffic. And I think he just like bottled up everything. Come on. This is Matt. Everyone also was with us in Israel. Welcome back.
Thank you.
To exile. Good to see you, man.
Thanks.
So, and you know, it's just, nothing ticked him off. The im yichas, this person never gets angry. And if he does get angry, yichas ka'as ma'at, he gets angry every once in a while, kamashanim, every few years, very little. So he's trying to show that you can have people that are so dramatically different from each other. Someone who's a hothead, everything ticks them off, everything upsets them. And then other people who are like, they're just so chill, you know? V'yesh adam shugava lev bi'alter. And there are people who have, anybody ever hear that expression, gava lev? What's lev? Lev is the heart. Gova is, what does it say in the English? It says prideful. But gava means great. Lev is heart. He's like, what does it mean, great? Bi'alter, he's a bal gaiva. That's not a nice thing to be called. Welcome. Why, man? What is a Baal Gaiva? Baal Gaiva is someone who is an egomaniac. He's all about himself or herself. Everything has to be, the attention always has to be on him or her. V'yeshu Shval, what's the opposite of being a Baal Gaiva? What would you say if someone is like very arrogant, very sort of self-absorbed, what's the opposite quality of being arrogant and self-absorbed?
Humility.
Someone who's exceedingly humble. And in Hebrew, what do we call such a person? What's that? No, do you have a... In Hebrew, we call him a shval ruach. Shval means low, ruach is spirit. And he's not a pushover. It sounds like a pushover. But he's just very self-effacing. You know, there's a story about a guy who comes into yeshiva, because that's one of the things that some of the yeshivas would work on, breaking your ego. I remember when I went to yeshiva when I was 18, I just told the story in Israel on Friday night. And the rabbi who I didn't know very well at the time, called me to his home at night. And he said to me, "You seem very popular with your friends. I need to know who are the Baal Gaivas." So I knew what Baal Gaivas, like who are the big egos. I'm like, I felt like I was being like, you know, interrogated. It's like a light, you know, piece of paper with a pen. You know, write down the egos. So I'm like, oh, I'm not going to write. What does that mean? Like, what do you mean write? I said, why? He says, because I can't teach Torah to someone whose ego is too big. And he says, there's not enough room in the world for God and too big of an ego. So I said, well, what are you going to do? He says, well, we're going to break him down a little boot camp. And then when we get him to be a little, we'll humble him a little, then we can teach him. Now, there's something to that. There's something to that, actually. But the Rambam is contrasting someone who is a Baal Gaiva to someone who's a Shval Ruach. Now, let's keep going. V'yeshu Baal Taiva. There is someone who's always, Taiva means a lustful, desiring, a physicality kind of person. And this person is never satisfied from walking around trying to get their taivas, their desires. It's referring to specifically physical desires, satisfied. What's the opposite of someone like that? Someone who just constantly needs physical gratification. It could be in food, it could be sex, it could be, I don't know, money, it could be anything which is physical. What's the opposite? A person who's so tahor, welcome guys, someone who's so tahor, who is pure, v'lo yitaveh afilu dvar ma'atim, This person does not desire after things, even the things that the body needs. Are you hungry? No. You need something to drink? No. The person is just very self-effacing, but when it comes to physical things. If you guys, I got one more handout if you guys don't mind sharing. Please, welcome. I don't mean to throw that at you. Just v'yesh bal nefesh rechava. And then there's a person who's greedy. No matter how much money he has, it's never enough. Kinyan Shnamar, turn the page. Oiv kesef lo yisba kesef. That's a verse, I think, from King Solomon. Someone who loves money will never have enough. You just love it for itself. Something wrong with liking money. Who doesn't like money? But if you see money as a tool for more important things in life, there's nothing wrong with loving money. But if somehow you fall in love with the money itself, then that becomes an issue. B'yesh mekatzer nafsho, and then there's the opposite. He's doing opposites here. And what's the other one? He says there's someone who's a misagef atzmo barav. Someone who's like a miser. He torments himself. And he's like a hoarder. He doesn't spend anything. He won't give anyone, lend anybody any money. He just, right? And then there's a spendthrift, the opposite of someone who's just like very irresponsible with their money. And they go out with their friends drinking and they just drop $200, $300. They don't have money like that. And they just, and they're not responsible like that. And he loses all of his money. And he gives more and more examples. He says, but you get the point. There are these qualities that people have, and they're very extreme, one from the next, and you will see different human beings possessing some of these extreme qualities. And he goes on a few more. Overly elated. Someone who's, what does that mean, overly elated? Someone who's overly elated. Someone who's always, I don't want to say always smiling, nothing wrong with having a little smile on your face, but a person is always giddy, is always laughing, is always like, hey! You know, you get that way when you go to like a bar, you go to a party, you go to something like that, you're like, hey! How long can you do that for? Like, I was just interviewed for ketubah.com, you know, what they do ketubahs, so they wanted a rabbi to talk about weddings. I just did that, I thought it was good PR for each other. And she wasn't great, the person who interviewed me, she was amazing. And then when the second the interview was over, she was like, you know, like, because you have to like put it on. You know, like you remember your bar mitzvah, your bat mitzvah. You're smiling the whole time. It's like no one could live like. So he says that. Now, what's the opposite? Depressed. Somebody walks around like the world's on their shoulders. And then he gives another example: stingy and free-handed, cruel, soft-hearted, coward and rash. And he goes on and on. So what the Rambam is setting up the extremes. Because as you're going to see in a moment, he's going to be following the famous Aristotelian medium, where extremes were always considered in Greek philosophy in general, and specifically Aristotle, to be evil. And the Rambam believed that this was a Torah idea, that anything followed to the extreme is bad, 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 and your job is to find what is in the middle, what is equidistant between the two extremes. And he believed that this idea applied to qualities and traits and personality development. Follow with me the next halacha, the last line on 15 or 14. V'yesh bein kol de'a v'de'a rechoka mimena b'katzeh acher de'ot beinonit. There are within, between all of these extremes, a de'a which is a beinonit. You know what a beinonit is? A beinonit is like someone in the middle. He's not here and he's not here, somewhere in the middle. Zu rechoka mizu, exactly equidistant from the two extremes. V'chol ha-deot, yesh mehen deot, shehen ladam, mitchilat b'riyato lefi teva gufo. He says something very, very interesting. He starts talking about the way each of us is sort of composed, personality-wise. I'll just read in the English. With regard to all the traits, a man has some from the beginning of his conception, in accordance with his bodily nature. Some are appropriate to a person's nature and will therefore be acquired more easily than other traits. Some traits he does not have from birth. He may have learnt them from others or turned to them on his own. This may have come as a result of his own thoughts or because he heard that this was a proper trait for him which he ought to attain. Therefore he accustomed himself to it until it became a part of himself. Anybody know the famous debate in the world of psychology that the Rambam is touching on.
Nature versus nurture.
Yeah, nature versus nurture. What is the Rambam saying? Is he in nature or is he in nurture? Does he believe that you're just born the way you are and the traits you have are the ones that you were born with, and the traits that you don't have, you're not going to have, someone else has got them? And that's sort of like a genetic predisposition. Or does he believe you can learn them?
No.
What?
You can learn.
He believes you can learn them? What did you say? Yeah, I think he's a little in the middle. What does that mean? He's in, because he does say, yeah, he says, first he says there are people, you're born with certain things. You are. And he says that certain things you're predisposed to developing them more easily. So for example, let's go to anger for a minute. Some people, it's easier for them to be calmer in certain situations than others. But the Rambam also says at the end that there are other traits, like you were saying, Matt, that you can learn. So he doesn't believe that you're boxed in by whatever traits you're born with. It could actually go either way. You have a little of both. I'm going to be speaking the Shabbat, if anyone's around, about the concept of free will. And next week we're going to talk a little more about that as well in this class. I mean, do we really believe we can change? God bless you.
Thank you.
Do we really, really believe we're capable of change? I don't want to tackle that issue right now, but he is saying that some traits are easier for some people to cultivate, and some traits are really harder for others to work on. If a person's a hothead, it's going to be a lot more difficult for that individual to remain calm in a given situation than it will be for someone who was sort of predisposed to be more calm. It was a little more chill. On the other hand, he says that there are traits that you can cultivate, you can develop on your own. And I'm going to table this, unless anybody wants to get into this a little more, for next week, because it does have to do with the concept of free will. Does Judaism believe that you can change your own fate? That you can control yourself so much that you can actually take your life in a certain kind of direction. We'll be talking a little more about that on Shabbat if anyone's around this weekend, on my talk on Shabbat morning. But I want to go back to the extremes in the middle, okay? Number three, the two extremes of each trait are at a distance and do not reflect a proper path. It's not fitting, he says, that a person should behave in accordance with these extremes. You should never accustom yourself, he says, to acting in an extreme manner. Now you'll see to every rule there's an exception. And you'll see Maimonides has some exceptions. But right now he's telling us the rule, which is middle. And if he finds his nature leans towards one of the extremes or adapts itself easily to it, or if he has learned one of the extremes and acts accordingly, he should bring himself back to what's proper and walk in the path of the good men, and that is the straight path. He says the Derech HaYashar, the straight path, is the path of the middle. Which is interesting. It might be a little, you might not, I don't know. A lot of people associate being religious with what? Being a little extreme, right? Like if you're a religious person, you're not looking for the middle. This is a total, what we call in Hebrew, chiddush. This is a total new insight into what it means to develop yourself religiously. The goal in Judaism is not to live on the extreme. And you'd be like, what do you mean? I've seen those mitzvos. Those are extreme. I've seen that Torah. The Rambam believed that everything God commanded the Jewish people to do was by definition in the middle. It's just that everybody's middle is someone else's extreme. It's all relative. Right? Because if you're coming from a certain place, then you might view a certain behavior as being extreme. But the question is, how is it objectively identified? You might subjectively think, oh, that's the middle. Now, what's a straight path? Take a look at number four. I'm really babbling way too much here. Does anybody have any questions or comments? Please, yeah.
Yeah, so would you say the Rambam, so I don't give this thought much, discussion much consideration, but I've heard in other religious conversations on this topic, so would he believe that some people are born evil, per se, or he would think that that's a learned trait?
you can't be considered evil if you're born that way. Think about it for a minute. Why do we consider Hitler evil? If we consider Hitler evil because he was born that way, then you can't really blame him for what he did. That's just who he is. That's the way God made him. Why should he be punished for simply behaving like he was hardwired or pre-programmed to behave? Now, there's a very subtle distinction between Judaism and Christianity when it comes to this. Because of Christianity's belief in original sin, they believe in what's called, it says this in the New Testament, to turn the other cheek, which means that you forgive someone even if they're not repentant. You're a good Christian if you can learn to forgive someone even if they're not sorry. Why? Because original sin means that you're tainted and that you can't help yourself. And ultimately, you are so lacking in redeeming qualities, you have to place your faith in a perfect being. That perfect being, of course, is Jesus. In a perfect being who can save you, because you're incapable of saving yourself. Judaism does not believe in that. Judaism believes in original sin. That's from our Old Testament, that story with Adam and Eve and sinning. But the original sin means that we have a Yetzirah. We have an evil inclination. But we also believe we have a good inclination. And we believe the good inclination can prevail over the good inclination, over the bad inclination. Which is why, if you do something wrong, we don't forgive you until you're really repentant. Until you stop the wrongdoing, you pay the money back, and you say you're sorry. Because we think you can do better. Because we think you can overcome the evil inclination. You have an evil inclination, according to Judaism. But the evil inclination can be prevailed over by the good inclination. In Christianity, you have to put your faith in someone greater.
So more power to the individual.
Much more power to the individual. And anyone who's evil is considered evil only because they made a choice to follow the wrong path in life. And we hold them accountable. If somebody was born bad... Now, I don't know if anybody wants to comment on this. It's a very important conversation. That doesn't mean we don't have predispositions. That doesn't mean that, let's say, Hitler, Yimach Shemo, didn't have certain proclivities towards evil. But ultimately, we believe he could have prevailed over them and used his great oratory skill and his brilliance and his strategic mind for the good.
Yeah.
I mean, almost anything in the world. I saw it today that it was in yesterday's Times, that a great scientist in Syria, we were just on the border, was taken out. Nobody was claiming responsibility, but everybody knows. It was a Syrian scientist, probably either not Iranian, but paid by the Iranians, who was getting too close to building a missile that Israel was concerned would be aimed at her. So Israel's done this many times in its history, never claims responsibility, but all of a sudden his car blows up on his way to work, this guy. And the question is, he's a brilliant scientist. What's he using his brilliance for? And it can go either way. Albert Einstein was a pacifist. He was a conscientious objector before the rise of the Nazi Party. And his science and was used to create an atom bomb, which was dropped on Hiroshima in Japan. He didn't want it used for that. Now, it might have been good, depending on who's the good guy and who's the bad guy, But at the end of the day, Judaism holds people accountable because we believe you have control. But that doesn't mean you don't have predispositions, and that's what the Rambam is saying. You do still have things that are more easily cultivated. Like Brian might be able to cultivate a certain quality and trait easily than me, but I might be able to cultivate a different trait. I might be able to stay away from some other negative thing easier than you. And we might just literally be born that way. But as long as we can still exert control over it, we get held responsible for our actions. Yeah, what were we going
to
say?
This applies to modern day law in America. So I work in criminal justice, and a lot of the times in our court system, if you're a suspect, and let's say you were abused as a child, that might be viewed as a mitigating circumstance.
Correct.
but sometimes it's not. So what the Jewish, how does Jewish law apply in the modern era? And I'm curious, this is like what I do for a living. If someone is sexually abused as a kid, and then right. they grow up to become a serial rapist.
Right. So we have an insanity defense, and that applies in Jewish law as well. If somebody cannot tell the difference between right and wrong, or they're so depraved, and then you're now getting into a little more of a gray area, where someone was a victim themselves of some kind of abuse, which makes them more likely, unfortunately, to do this to someone else. You know, I don't know if you remember this, my wife is like addicted to Law and Order. And by the way, they just keep you going and watching, because by the time the one's over, the next one's just on. They don't give you a commercial or any break. You're just like, you're in the next one. So you can like binge watch Law and Order. So I used to teach a lot of classes, and like Law and Order has a lot of... So one Law and Order was based on... I looked it up. I checked out Westlaw for this. It actually happened that a kid, a high school kid, a senior in high school, was on a hockey team, really good hockey team. The coach pulled him out last second. I don't know, there was some scouts from a college, and the father went ballistic because he thought like the chances of his kid getting a scholarship, a hockey scholarship to some school, was now. He lunged at the coach, started strangling the coach, didn't mean to kill him, but he killed him. And he was brought up on charges of manslaughter, not intentional homicide, but manslaughter. And his lawyer tried to argue that he could not be held accountable for the crime. Why? Because given his background and propensity for violence, and how important it was for him to get his kid into that thing, and then I know you got that look on your face, like you're disgusted by this. How could he even argue this? He argued it. Now the jury did not buy it, and he was convicted of manslaughter at the end of the day. But because I think we're uncomfortable, and I would say the same would apply to the Jewish tradition. I think we're uncomfortable saying, because you saw something happen in your life, you have no choice but to repeat that same evil behavior. But that's different than someone who is so depraved and is so incapable of telling what's the language in the law for the insanity? They cannot tell the... What is it? Like, you can't... Any lawyers here? Anybody watches a lot of Law and Order, you'll know this. You can't tell the difference between right and wrong a little, or whatever it is. So I don't think that would suffice. I think we, at the end of the day, we hold people accountable. But it is a mitigating circumstance. Like, if you're easily angered, you're a hot-tempered person, and that's just the way you're hardwired, then you have to be your significant other or your friends have to understand that that is a struggle that you have. And that they shouldn't hold you to the same level as someone who's totally chill. And we don't believe God holds us to that either. God knows what our struggles are. And everybody comes into this world with a different struggle. But to then go to the other extreme and say, we have no control over it. We have no control over it. I can't really prevent myself from... My mother was a klepto. Her mother was a klepto. So you can't expect me, when going into a grocery store, not to steal something. You know what I mean? That doesn't hold up in court. It doesn't hold up in halakha, because at the end of the day, people still have the power. Now, it's interesting in Christianity, because we believe in forgiveness too, but we don't believe in forgiveness for the sake of forgiveness. We believe in forgiveness to reconcile. It's not good energy to carry around, and you want to rehabilitate the relationship. So you don't want to keep staying angry at somebody. It's not good. And we also go before God. And we say, God, stop being angry with me, cut me a little slack, and then we don't do that with our fellow human beings. So that's not cool. But we're not doing it because we don't think people are capable. You know, like, you know, you're a sinner. And that's what Christianity, I mean, not all forms of Christianity, but, you know, classical Catholicism teaches, that you're a born sinner, and that's why... I have a Eli talk on this, if anyone wants to listen to it. It's called Failing Forward. I will talk about this, and it's an interesting contrast between Judaism and Christianity. What are we going to say?
So, what if you have developmental problems? Mm-hmm. And I take this off of current events. So, as I mentioned, I'm from South Florida. I didn't go to Douglas High School in Parkland, but I went to a rival high school, and I'm fascinated by what happened. And they determined that Nicholas Cruz, the accused shooter, had problems starting when he was 3. He was developmentally slow. And the school didn't do anything, or they did very little to help him. So what would Judaism say? Your brain is wired a certain way, that he kind of had that predisposition to, like, he couldn't help himself.
Well, but, I mean, the fact that he was ill from a young age, I don't know if that means he was predisposed to murder. I think if that could be argued, he might be able to get off on an insanity defense. And he might really be not, it might be unfair to hold such a person accountable for their actions if it's, you know, but I don't know if that was the case. I don't know. And that's what his lawyer should argue, if that's really the situation where he's completely out of control. He's completely not able to control his behavior. He's got these problems, and I mean, it's just sad that somebody can go that many years in our society and not be recognized and helped and treated for that. And I'll tell you, we had a father. I interviewed a father of one of the girls. I don't know, we put it actually on Facebook Live. I was in the hotel in Florida. I was a Scholem residence for Passover, and what was so upsetting, he didn't get into the murder at all. But what was so upsetting, listening to the dad talk, and he's an amazing guy. And he went around the country talking, and he met with the president twice about increasing security in schools, because there were so many opportunities to stop this guy that were just not in place in our schools. And that's something, I know that's not the issue you brought up, but that's something that should be thought about also, because that's the first priority in our society, which is having schools safe for our children. And that just was not the case. This shouldn't have happened. You know, so many kids, and taking so long for the police to, the whole thing, which was, it was a disaster. But in terms of him, you know, I don't know, you really need an expert psychiatrist to determine whether or not this person is actually able to control their behavior. And if not, and then this person needs to, you know, society needs to be protected from such an individual also.
No, it's interesting, because it's a very, Coral Springs, Parkland has a high Jewish population.
I know,
so it's interesting to see how the Jewish perspective, especially since they're considering the death penalty and other things. So, thank you.
That's a whole other discussion about the death penalty. it's a very gray area in Judaism, because even though the Torah has the death penalty on the books, it's almost impossible for it to be carried out in reality. If you think it's hard to convict somebody of a crime under American law, the burden of proof that the prosecution has to satisfy, it's more difficult even under Jewish law. So even though the death penalty is there, so it's not so clear. All right, we're getting a little far flung. Oh boy, let's get back into... So we're talking about the middle path, the straight path, which involves discovering the midpoint. Look at number 4 on page 20. Are we in the English here? Page 18, rather, on the left. It's basically discovering the midpoint temperament of each and every trait that a person possesses within his personality. And that refers to the trait which is equidistant from either the extremes. And therefore, a person should evaluate their traits, calculate them, direct them along the middle path. For example, okay, he was speaking in generalities. Let's get specific. A person should not be wrathful, easily angered. What's the opposite of getting too easily angered all the time? What's the opposite? Like literally on the opposite extreme of someone who's always... Everything upsets this guy.
Ambivalent.
Yeah. Ambivalent. Like, nothing matters. The Rambam says, like a mace, like a dead person. Person has no... It seems like the person has no principles. And you can't go through life like that either. You can't educate children if you don't get upset sometimes with them. Now, the best thing when you get upset, and the Rambam actually speaks about this, is to control your anger when you're getting upset. But you have to demonstrate some emotion, like it's moving you, or else your kids will be, they won't know what's right and what's wrong. Or a teacher also on some level. So it's not good to be totally chill like it's all good. No, not everything is good. There's a lot of bad stuff. And if you don't demonstrate when something is bad, then we're not going to... So he says, he should not be wrathful, easily angered, nor be like the dead without feeling. Rather, so what's the middle? Adopt an intermediate course. Turn the page. I.e., display anger when the matter is serious enough to warrant it. Now, how do you know? You get angry when it's worthwhile. And that's why you have, that's what Torah is about. Torah is there to teach us what's important in life, what's not important, what's really upsetting. Is this really worthwhile for me to get upset over? Because it was like this and it should have been like that? Come on. Really? But other things are really worthwhile to get angry over and to be upset over. Mm-hmm. Similarly, you should not desire anything other than which the body needs. Now, when we talked about someone who's overly physically desirous all the time. So and then what was the opposite extreme? The person just negates their body. I don't need this, I don't need that. And they're just like, almost like an ascetic. The Rambam doesn't like that either. Similarly, you should not desire anything other than what the body needs and cannot exist without. Also, he should not... I don't know if this would work anymore today. He should not labor in his business except to gain what he needs for immediate use. Meaning, not to become a total workaholic. Work, 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 and work. You got to know what your body needs. You got to know what you need. And not to go to the opposite extreme. He should not be overly stingy nor spread his money about. What's in the middle of being overly stingy and not being too loose with your money too? So what he should what? Turn the page. Give charity according to his capacity and lend to the needy as is fitting. That's why it says you're supposed to try to give ma'aser, 10% of your income to charity, but not more than chumash, not more than 20%, because you don't want to end up on the other side. It's too much. I don't know when the last time somebody told you, stop giving so much charity, right? But you, there is a point where it's too much. And by the way, that applies also in helping people. If you are too, I mean, therapists have this issue. I know I have a lot of friends, therapists. If you, you know, you need to learn how to create a little boundary, or a doctor. Not too much of a boundary. You don't want to become, you know, Mr. Spock, and with no emotions and feelings. A little bedside manner wouldn't hurt. You know, a little love, but you get too attached and you give too much of yourself, you lose yourself. It's very, very important. Judaism, I'm going to quote from the same rabbi I quoted before, is a normal religion. It is not out there to get us to become extremists. It is out there to get us to follow the straight path, which is the middle. You should not be overly elated and laugh exceedingly, right? Excessively. Everything is a joke. Everything is a joke, right? Or walk around depressed and sad. What's the middle between everything is and everything is like the world? What's the middle? It says in the Perkei Avot, Havedan, no, Havei Mekabel Kol Adam B'Sever Panim Yafot. And the Maimonides is quoting from the Ethics of Our Fathers. Person should greet everybody with B'Sever Panim. What's a Panim? Your face, Yafot, a pleasant face, smile. Not a crazy smile, not like you're freaking me out with that smile. Not like, you know, but like a just pleasant. And by the way, it's a really important trait, because even though we may not feel like being like that on the outside, it helps. It actually affects our inside. We know that we are the products of our behavior. Our emotions are affected. That's why you put on a nice jacket or a dress, you dress up a little, it affects these behavioral, you know, external things can actually affect the way we feel about ourselves. So greeting other people nicely, but not crazy nicely, but not like a depressed person either. This path, he says, is the path of the wise, and each man whose traits are intermediate and equally balanced can be called a wise man. A person who carefully examines behavior and therefore deviates slightly is called pious. All right, we're going to skip this a little. Now, I just want to mention one or two exceptions, because we're going to finish up. I'm not going to spend... Maybe we'll talk about this next week. There are exceptions. Anybody know the exception to the middle road? When is it okay to actually be on the extreme? What's that? So in other words, if there's like an extreme situation in life, maybe that would warrant an extreme reaction. That's interesting to think about that. That's a good answer. When else would it be important, at least temporarily, to act in the extreme?
To save a life,
good. You can do anything.
Also, like, to get back in the middle?
Yeah, that's what I'm looking for. Because sometimes you're on the extreme already. And how do you get to the middle? And that's what's called boot camp. So let's say I gave my rabbi a list of arrogant guys going into the yeshiva, which I didn't do. I didn't break. He might do a little boot camp on them in order to get them not to walk around like, I'm a nothing, I'm a nobody, I can't even look at myself. No, that's not what he wants. You're supposed to have confidence. Confidence is really important in life. But how do you get confidence if you're on the other? So sometimes you need to go to the other extreme to get into the middle. Now, follow with me. One last idea from the Rambam. Really important. Page 29. The Rambam asks, V'ketzad. 29 in the Hebrew or 28 in the English. It's number 7. Ketzad yargil adam atzmo b'deo. It's very nice to say we're supposed to be in the middle. But how do you get there? Let's say you're not in the middle on some of these traits. Most people are in the middle on a lot of these things. So how do you do it? So the Rambam suggests. He says, Ketzad yargil adam atzmo b'deot elu. How should a person train himself to follow these temperaments? Ad shikvubo. Until they should become kovea. You know when you're doing something that's not natural and you have to kind of put it on. The Rambam is saying, how do we get these to be actually part of our personalities? So we don't have to think about it. And he says, Yase v'yishne v'yishalish. Do it once, do it twice, do it 3 times. V'masim she'osel p'yadeo te'emtsayit. To do what? Keep repeating it until it eventually you just keep repeating the middle road temperament. Whatever the middle road thing, you just keep doing it. The yachzor behem tamin, you keep going over it, ad shiyu ma'aseim kalim, until it starts getting easier. V'lo yeh behem tarach alav, turning the page, 31-30, until it's no longer a tircha, it's no longer a difficulty. And then these temperaments become a fixed part of your personality. Anybody know who proposed this in psychology?
Yes, Skinner.
Right. Right. He was he was one of the great founders of the behavioralist school, which is a little different than like your classic psychoanalysis, try to dig deep, sit on some therapist couch for the next 5 or 6 years, figure out what your mother did or didn't do. That I'm not making fun. Sometimes psychoanalysis is the only cure for certain elements in psychological issues. But sometimes a behavioralist approach can be very effective and quicker, which is that you simply reinforce and repeat the desired behavior until it eventually becomes a fixed part of a person's personality. It is a little of a superficial way of dealing with it. You're not really getting to the core root. What is leading me to be so stingy with my money? What is leading me to be so running after, I don't know, whatever it is, being so frivolous with what are the opposite click, right? That would be, I guess, the ideal, is to really understand why you're doing this, what's bringing you to that. But sometimes we don't have the time to figure all that out all the time. And just knowing that you're doing the right behavior could actually be a very redeeming kind of thing and could actually get into your kishkas a little. It could actually be part of your personality. I'm not suggesting it for every problem, but the Rambam is suggesting that if you want to, you know, refine your personality, figure out what the desired behaviors are. And what are the desired behaviors? The middle. So let's say when it comes to humility, it's not being overly effacing and it's not being arrogant. It's being confident, but not being, there's a middle. Let's say anger, right? The one side is that everything ticks you off, nothing ticks you off. Everything is, it's all good, right? Finding out what are the things that really are worthy of me getting upset with. Trying really hard only to get upset with those things. And just repeating those behaviors. Sometimes it's not doing certain things. And just trying to refrain from allowing, let's say, anger. Anger is a really, really difficult thing to control. In another class, one of these four classes, I'm going to spend a little more time giving some advice and some of the things that I've learned from some other books and some other texts about trying to control anger. Anger is one of the exceptions. The Rambam views anger as such a destructive force that he says it's okay to go to the opposite extreme. What's the opposite extreme? Nothing's bothering you. You boot camp yourself to get to a place where, like, you're just getting to a place where it's no longer bothering you, because you're just doing it again and again and again. It's not the ideal to stay there, but you might have to go there in order to get back to the middle path. And certainly with something like anger, he gives an example. Let's just finish up. Since the Creator is called by these terms, God is referring to, and they make up the middle path, which we are obligated to follow. This is the path that's called the path of God. This is the heritage which our patriarch Abraham and his descendant taught to his descendants. For I have known God, I have known him, so that he will command his descendants to keep the path of God. The path of God, ki adativ leman yitzaveh vegomer, derech Hashem, the way of Hashem is the path of the middle, says the Rambam. Vaholech b'derech zu, and anyone who walks on this path, mevi tova ubracha la'atzma, will bring great goodness and blessing to himself. And it's a really, really important thing. I'm going to leave you with that. There's so much more. This is actually more than chapter 1. You can take this back if you would like to do a little more work and reading on this. But I ask you if you could just bring it back, because it's actually got all of the chapters. I'll mention one or two other ideas that we're going to be touching on as well. One last thing before you go. I'm sorry. That was a false ending here. Take a look at page 3435. 3435. I want to get a little more specific before we finish. Look at the English on 34. How are they to be healed? We tell the wrathful man to train himself to feel no reaction, even if he is beaten or cursed. He should follow this course of behavior for a long time until the anger is uprooted from his heart. Now, I don't know how you do this exactly. Do you tell your significant other, I want you to berate me for the next 2 hours, and I'm just going to sit here and take it? I don't know. It's a little. That's what he's saying a little. He's like, tell the wrathful man to train himself to feel no reaction. How do you feel no reaction when someone's cursing you out, or someone's beating you, or someone's doing something terrible to you?
Have a high self-esteem.
We're talking about someone who doesn't have that necessarily. I mean, right, if you have self-esteem, enough self-esteem, you can maybe draw from that reservoir, and maybe that's just like a tip. Like, there's a part of you that does feel good about yourself, kind of. If you can get into that place when you're being abused verbally, which, by the way, you're not allowed to do. It's a Torah prohibition to verbally abuse another person. But the Rambam is saying is that that's how ultimately we develop ourselves, is by just getting to a place where we just don't feel it anymore. We don't feel that negativity. The man who's full of pride should cause himself to experience disgrace. How do you do that? He should sit in the lowliest of places, dress in tattered rags which shame the wearer, until the arrogance is uprooted from his heart, and he returns to the middle path, which is the proper path. When he returns to the middle path, he should walk in it the rest of his life. One should take a similar course with each of the other traits. A person who swayed in the direction of one of the extremes should move in the direction of the opposite extreme and accustom himself to that for a long time, until he has returned to the proper path, which is the midpoint for each and every temperament. I'm sorry? Very dramatic. It is. I mean, it's boot camp. Like, how else are you supposed to, if you got a real chip on your shoulder and you're trying to get rid of it? Now, you don't want to subject yourself too much to this. It could, you know, you could, everyone has a tipping point here, you know? But you want to get to a place where those things are not affecting you in the same way. And that's not an easy thing. I don't recommend you try this on your own. If there is something you're trying to work on, you want to speak to somebody about it, and But I think just the general idea that I'm trying to share with you tonight, which is figure out, let's just not behave. Let's not just act. We just act in life. We're just too busy to think about things for too long. We just go ahead and we act. No, the Rambam is saying, figure out what are the behaviors that are desirable. And he's telling us, from what his teachers, from the Torah, from Aristotle, that a desirable behavior is what's in the middle. Figure out what that behavior is and start cultivating it. Start doing it. He's not asking us to delve so deeply into the psychology behind it and how, why am I not attracted to it? Why is this so difficult? Just do it. Keep doing it. Obviously, it's more complicated than I'm presenting it. But to whatever degree we can apply this to our lives, I think it could be a very, very helpful exercise in refining our personalities and developing ourselves as we approach the high holidays. Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur is not just the time to come up, I'm sorry I did this, I'm sorry I did that. It's a time to ask ourselves, are we any different in terms of, we all got stuff, everyone has their own demons. We're not proud of them. And Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur is a great time to tackle one of them. Don't try to tackle too many. You try to take on too much, the Talmud says you'll end up with nothing. Pick one thing you want to refine in your personality, and there's some advice as to how to go ahead and do that. And by the way, don't expect results overnight. And don't expect, all of a sudden I got it out, and it's not going to pop back. It's often one step forward, two steps back. But don't give up. Just keep pushing forward, and you can eventually, I'm speaking to myself, we all have our stuff, to try to, it's always great to have somebody else to talk to about this. And not to have to go at this alone. We're just a little embarrassed. And some of the stuff is maybe not to be shared. Some of it's between us and God. It's not anyone else's business, you know. But sometimes we might need a friend to help go through this process. Because it's not simple. But this is real. And this could be a very inspiring experience. I think it could be very uplifting and a changing experience. Any comments or questions about any of this? No? We're good?
What about surrounding yourself around the right people?
Yeah, I didn't even touch on that. He didn't mention that yet. So the rabbis in the ethics of our fathers teach very famously, Oy l'rasha. You ever hear this? Oy l'shcheino. How do you define the word oy? Exactly the way it sounds. Oi to the Russia and oi to his neighbor. Which means? Anybody know the episode in the Torah?
Yeah, you shouldn't have yourself. It's worse to surround yourself with an evil neighbor than it is with an evil Jew.
Right, so I don't think any of us really hang out with evil people, but we might hang out with people, or we might get drawn to people that have certain negative qualities and traits. Now, I'm not telling you to dump all your friends, because then you'll have no friends left. None of us is perfect. But you might have to consider who you hang out with. You know, I always said this. Let's say it's Lashon Hara. Let's say one of the things we're working on in the coming year is bad-mouthing other people. It makes me feel good. I get a quick high. Lashon Hara is such a difficult thing to rein in. But if you think about it, we often speak ill of other people around certain people. Because either we're trying to impress them, or, they don't want to blame them, they bring it out in me. But maybe it's something a friend or two of yours, or mine, is accustomed to. And therefore it's easier to do that because they're bad-mouthing somebody I can say something to. So one of the things you might need to do is think a little about who you're spending a lot of time with, and how you're spending time. There are ways of not ditching the friends, but changing the way you spend time. Because gossip usually comes out of hanging out a little too long with certain people. You know what I mean? So do something a little more productive so that you don't get to starting to talk about other people. Because that just happens naturally. And it's fun. And it makes you feel better, especially when someone else looks a little worse. There's a famous story in the Torah. You know Korach, who rebelled against Moses, and the earth opened up and swallowed him and his whole group. the tribe of Reuven was somehow involved. Not the whole tribe, but certain people. And the rabbis asked, how did they get involved in that controversy? And they say, Oy la Rasha, Oy la Shechena, because the tribe of Reuven happened to be geographically in close proximity to Korach and his group. They were just neighbors. And we have a tendency to get sucked in. And the other way around, you play tennis. I have a son who's a really good tennis player. And like, always tried, I always told him, just keep playing with people that are better than you. They'll make you feel much better about yourself to play with people that are worse. But if you want to get better, play with people that are better. And it's a great lesson for life. And we're always trying to do that professionally to advance ourselves. But we often don't think that way in terms of our moral and ethical development. We all want to get better as people, as humans, as Jews. So let's hang out with individuals that bring that out. Again, that doesn't mean you have to ditch your friends that don't bring that out, but maybe there's a way of changing the nature of the interaction, you know, so that it doesn't descend into gossip or whatever else that we end up doing, you know. It's a great question because this is, we've been talking a little tonight in a vacuum almost, as though we can solve all these issues ourselves. A lot of it comes down to the people we're spending time with, you know, people we choose to surround. And by the way, sometimes we don't have a choice at work. You can't choose the perfect people at your job, right? And sometimes the job's great, but the people you have to work with aren't so awesome. So it's not so simple. So you just want to make sure that that doesn't become your only group of friends, or that you can minimize some of the interaction or change it somehow. I wrote this in one of the in chapters in my book. It's coming out in a couple of weeks. Having a launch party. It's the first time I'm announcing it, September 5th. So one of the things I wrote about was, you know, I've had a number of students over the years that have complained to me that they were the subject of great abuse at work, all forms of different types of abuse. And a lot of people feel very trapped because they need the job, or they like the prestige that the job gives them. But their soul is taking a serious beating. And sometimes it's a subtle kind of abuse, which is wreaking havoc on them in a way that they're not even aware of. And, you know, a lot of people, well, I don't have a choice, you know. It's a choice between, you know, allowing oneself to really be damaged and trying to blow the whistle on a boss or a colleague that's acting inappropriately, even if that creates a controversy. I mean, we've seen this. This is what's happened in the news in the last couple of months. And I think it's a very, very healthy thing. I think a lot of people, because New York is such a pressuring place to make money, that people are willing to swallow a lot. You know, people are just willing to suck it up when a lot of not cool stuff is going on. And we suffer a lot as a result. And look, it's easy for me to say just quit or tell on your boss and then you lose your job. It's not always so simple. But sometimes that's what's necessary, you know. So we don't always have the choice who to hang out with, you know. But sometimes we do have a choice, even at work, you know. Any other questions or comments? Okay, I'm just trying to make it easy for you to speak and share. And there's so much amazing stuff in here. We're going to talk. We're going to talk a little more about the free will issue that we touched on tonight. Next week, I also want to get into other traits of jealousy. I want to talk a little more about anger and some of the other things that we're not so proud of, that we have allowed to become part of our personalities, and how, according to Maimonides, we can begin to lose some of those things. And I also want to talk about some of the mitzvot in the Torah that we're commanded to love our neighbor as ourself, to not harbor hate, to not become jealous. These are actually mitzvot. They're actually biblical commands. And we kind of, you know, we listen to them and we're like, really? I can't control my emotions. So I want to get into that a little. Because if you don't really believe you can control some of these things, then saying you got to do it is like, It doesn't make any sense. You have to really believe that you can, that any of us is capable of change. If you don't believe that, then much of this doesn't really. And that's, I'm going to start with that next week. Because there are people who philosophically don't believe in change.
It sounds like it's a process. It doesn't sound like overnight people attain self-control. It sounds like it's a process.
Right, 100%. But there are actually people who, philosophers, who taught. They were groups, predeterminists, fatalists. And there are people still alive promoting some of this ideology that you can't change.
You can't.
You cannot, that human beings are not capable of change. And that ultimately we are the products of our creation or environment. And that we're just not capable of it. I'm going to be talking about this on every week of this course. Because the more you believe in your power to change, the more you'll end up doing it.
Yeah, but the interesting thing is that if this given society you're living in sees something as a criminal act, then they expect you to, maybe not overnight, but eventually attain self-control.
100%. Listen, in our society, and this is the way the world of psychology is going, we are finding a gene for everything. We are finding a physiological basis in diet, in everything. And what that ultimately does is free us of responsibility. Because it's like, this is just the way I was hardwired. I saw that politically it happened. I don't want to get political here, but I remember in the heat of the Second Intifada, I heard people actually say, well, what do you expect somebody to do who has all of their hope taken away from them and is living under occupation? What can you expect them to do other than strap bombs to their body and walk into a cinema and blow up innocent people? Of course they would do something. They have no free will. I mean, it's a ridiculous argument, and it's being accepted in certain intellectual circles in a very subtle way, and it's part of the world of psychology today that change is not something we're really so capable of, and that we're just basically products of our environment. By the way, great book to read on this is Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. He believed, and he was a survivor of Auschwitz, he was a he was a student of Freud, of psychoanalysis, and he started his own form. It's called logotherapy. He believed that the Nazis were trying to prove that if you take a human being and you subject him to certain circumstances, you control their behavior like an animal. And Viktor Frankl said that in the camps, every time a Jew shared his rations, his meager rations, with his cellmates, with his bunkmates, they defied that view of the Nazis. The Nazis were performing all sorts of crazy, not only scientific, but social science experiments, trying to prove certain things. You know, as part of their whole superior race ideology. It was sick. And he said that, Frankl argued that the ultimately, when acts of chesed, however rare they might have been under those circumstances, disprove what the Nazis were trying to ultimately demonstrate. And that we're not complete products of our environment, just instinctual animals that respond to stimuli and that's it. But that we can actually rise above using free will. And we're going to explore that a little more. It's a very, very important part of Jewish philosophy, I think. Was there another question or comment? Yeah.
I mean, just when you're talking about this in turn certain genes on and off. So even if we're born with a genetic disposition, he actually proved somehow, I don't remember the details, that is only part of the equation, and the rest is the environment that affects how these genes come into play.
That's interesting. So you're saying even the genes are subject to, even the genes are not hard and fast.
It's called epigenetics. It's been in Europe for like 10 years now. Wow. It's just getting hot here.
Interesting. I've heard of the word. I'm not familiar with it whatsoever. That's interesting. Cool. Thank you. We'll to be continued. You're all welcome to come Friday night, FNL, 7 o'clock, 6:30 music beforehand. We have great spirited services there every Friday night and Shabbat morning. I'm going to be speaking this particular Shabbat, begins the month of Elul, and also starts, also talks about free will. It's in this week's Parsha. The opening verse speaks about choosing your path in life. So I'm going to be talking a little more about that this Shabbat. And thank you guys for coming.
Thank you.
Pleasure. Have a great night, everyone, and we'll see you next week. Yeah, try to stick with us for the next couple of weeks. So we have we can build on this together. Can you actually turn that off?
It's good to recharge.
Thank you, Dan.
Like the whole.
Anybody interested? I'm teaching at 9:15, which is 5 minutes ago. Upstairs, Basila Sashara.
Thank you.
What are you teaching? Or do you have to be part of the
fellowship? Come. No, it's not a fellowship.
What is it on?
Basila Sashara.
So what's the subject?
Oh, I'm doing Zihi Root, watchfulness. I'm up to chapter 3 of Basila Sashara. I'm doing like a chapter 3.
When is it going to finish?
Now it's like 45 minutes. I'll try to finish by 10. Probably 10.
I'm going to stick around.